ready to go. Any minute.
Okay, 12 minutes after the...
each other up and then pick up the pieces later with their control. Have you got a comment about all of that?
Absolutely, because you see, when we discuss these things, as you so aptly do in your program, and we all try to chip in from every part of the world, the view is different depending on where you are on the pyramid, how high you've climbed up. So, for example, if you're way at the base of the pyramid, you figure, well, you know, this world is totally violent, it's anti-democratic, and so forth. As you go up the pyramid, you realize, oh, there's powerful people here, the President of the United States, the President of France, the Prime Minister of Britain. You keep going up the pyramid, and you realize that real power is with the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergs, the CFRs. You go further up, and you find that you have Zionism, you have Freemasonry, you have certain religions. But if you can get way, 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 way up at the tip of the pyramid, the tip of the pyramid, which might be, I don't know, 20, 30 people, whatever, I can guess some of the names, they're even way above the Zionist organization.
I don't think so. I think they're Zionists themselves. I think they're Jews. Now, let me tell you who I think they are. We've got the Honig family out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We've got the Con Loeb fortune. We have Warburg money. We have Schiff money. We have Oppenheimer money. We have, of course, the Rothschild money. We have Rockefeller money. All of these groups are sitting at the pinnacle. Of course, I believe Brofman, with his power, has moved himself into the upper circle. But in almost every instance, you can see that they work out of the trust system, where they don't actually show you their wealth. They do it through having these blind trusts or these blind investment funds. Or, for example, very few French people know that BNP Paribas, their largest bank in France, is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Rothschild family. But, you know, you can go over to Britain and find out that Mr. Mendelssohn is an employee of Rothschild throughout his career. And when he wasn't working in the government, went back to work for Rothschild. So my point is, at the very top, there is a Jewish group. And now, they're not necessarily Ashkenazis either. Some of them are Sephardic.
Now, Daryl, I agree with you on that. And let me just add one very brief point. What I'm saying is that the Zionist political organization and the Zionist entity in Palestine are themselves subordinated to the very tip of the pyramid, who happen to coincide and be very sympathetic with Zionism, but they themselves, as you say, they're mostly Jewish families, they themselves have a much farther and much greater interest and goals that even Zionists might have regarding a specific territory in one specific part of the world.
That's right.
I would venture to remember what Albert Pike, the Illuminati from the United States, said in the 19th century. He said that in the 20th century there would be three great wars.
Yes.
The First World War would destroy some of the key anti-Semitic royal families. The Second World War would weaken Europe in relative terms vis-a-vis the United States and the USSR. And the Third World War would be a clash between Islam and certain Zionist groups. And he was saying this, I think, because in a way, just as when the world went from the Yalta world to globalization, it was necessary for the Soviet Union to go, and it went, and Zbigniew Brzezinski foretold that 20 years before. Now that the world is going from globalization to world government, it's necessary for the United States to go. That's why, in a way, I think Barack Obama is going to go down in history as the last president of the United States. And now we are going towards world government, where even the Zionist organization throughout the world will have to align themselves to certain new fads, because it came out in the Financial Times of the 8th September of last year, where Gideon Rachman, one of their chief journalists, a Jew himself, said, it's now we're going for world government. They are already announcing it officially from the pages of the Financial Times in London. The next stage now is to go to world government. And under world government, there will probably be a military capital in Washington, a political capital in London, and very likely a spiritual capital in Jerusalem.
Well, that's right. And interesting, when you talk about the Financial Times of London being a Pearson company owned by Rothschild again. You know, the Salzburg family owned the papers in the United States, and that's also Austrian, and goes back to the Honig family and others. Those core families that have been around forever, and you can go back to the Federal Reserve's founders. You know, when you were talking about Chase Manhattan and J.P. Morgan and the rest, you're probably aware that when J.P. Morgan died, he was assumed to be, or believed to be, one of the wealthiest men in America. Well, when he died and all of his affairs were settled, all of the money that he owned was about $21 million. $21 million when he died was a lot of money, but it certainly wasn't the billions he had built up in the enterprise. That money was Rothschild's.
Right.
And so, when you take a look at the gold mines of South Africa, I did a show on the gold mining interests. The New York and London banks own all the stock in these companies. And, I mean, the largest gold miners in South Africa are pulling all of the assets of South Africa out of the ground and shipping those out of the country and paying their miners a subsistence wage at best, with very little regard for their safety in many cases, problems with health care, housing, the whole bit. And government after government that is installed in that country is behind the scenes run by Zionist Jews again. And you'll note that the founding party of the ANC was financed with money from Zionist Jews. So again, we get right back to the fact that the Jewish power and money is at the top of this pyramid, and of course the exact human beings at the top are debatable and like individually, but family wise and influence wise, it's not that debatable at this point for me anyway. I've knocked it all the way down to the top here, I think.
Well, look at the parallels, because I was listening very carefully to what you were saying about South Africa. In Argentina, the largest landowner who owns huge amounts of land out in Patagonia, especially, and in the northeast of the country, and who owns a lot of key real estate, very, very well-known landmark buildings in Buenos Aires and other cities, is a guy by the name of Eduardo Elstein. Now, Eduardo Elstein is a local representative, so to speak, a stand-in for the George Soros Enterprises. And he was also named by Edgar Bronfman to be the treasurer of the World Jewish Congress. Now, these are not coincidences. Again, we see how the whole network works. And one of the main non-governmental organizations trying to get control over the Patagonia, which is the southern part of Argentina, is the Patagonia Conservancy Agency. And that has its head office in Bariloche, which is one of the main towns in southern Argentina. And guess who the chairman of that is? Henry Paulson from Goldman Sachs. So when you start seeing how the whole network ties in together, you can start understanding. In a way, you know, this is like an impressionist painting. If you look at a painting by Renoir, too close up, it's just a lot of little dots. You say, well, I can't make this out, dots and this and that. What you got to do is you have to look at the dots and then move away. And when you move away and you look at the full picture, you say, ah, now I understand.
That's right. And the fact of the matter is, you know, with the George Soros Fund, when he was imploding the tiger economies because they were afraid those economies were going to become too independent, because a lot of the monies that were being hived off of the profits needed to be resent back to their London masters. So what happened was Soros, of course, with his directors, he's only a top middleman. He's not even at the top of this, but he's got a lot of monetary influence. He went out. And when Malaysia said, okay, look, we're not gonna go the way of everybody else after the implosion, we are going to figure out a way not to take IMF World Bank money to bring ourselves out of this mess. However, we're not going to reject you out of hand. We're going to allow you to stay in Malaysia, but Tan Mahathir Mohamad, because you know what happens if you kick the IMF World Bank's masters out of your country, then you go to war.
Oh yeah,
right. Yeah. So the point was is that he said, well, no, we're not going to kick you out, and in fact, we may need your money at some point here. But right now, what we're going to basically do is we're going to try to retrench, we'll try to pay off what we can with the best we can, and then relaunch ourselves. And exactly what he did, they were the first country to get out of the mess. They didn't buy into the big debt. And it was this guy Anwar who Mahathir Mohamad ended up railroading out of political power. He was a stooge for the Soros boys. And this guy, Mahathir Mohamad, knew it. And he got his control over the police to get this guy indicted and jailed.
Got him arrested, I think.
Got him arrested on, excuse me, on morals charges. Now, you know, that wasn't maybe the most moral thing to do because there was no proof that any of that was real. But he did it for very good reasons because this guy was, had he taken over, they would have bought into the IMF, World Bank, lock, stock, and barrel, and all kinds of problems would have surfaced. So, you know, it can be fought back upon, again, Mahathir Mohamad did it. But now, 20 years now later, it's about 20 years since all that stuff happened, not 18 years, Malaysia is just as much in the mess as anybody else. And, you see, now, here's what I understand. The country that has been selected, everyone thinks it's China for the next economic engine of this growth thing that they want to happen. The big investments and the big money from these top Zionists is actually betting on India.
Right.
And now China's production capacity is certainly going to be a big part of the growth story. But the real control, the real international investment in technology and engineering and technology, that's being done through the Indian connection. And that was predetermined through Rothschild investment back in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And he stated as much in an interview by saying that he believed the big growth story of the next millennia will be India. And he's followed that with his money. So when we take a look at the story here, while India will be folded into the world single government, it will still be one of the production centers and the control points. And you know the Mossad is in serious control of that country. And do you have any statements to make about the recent Mumbai nonsense being run out of the Shabbat Lubavitch group and the rest?
Well, yeah, that was one of the most, shall we say, surprising episodes that we've seen of late. That I think ties in quite neatly with what you're saying about the future plans regarding India. There is an all-out effort for the control of India. Pakistan will also be part of that scheme.
Yep.
Keep that very much in mind.
Yep.
And I think that when you refer to the Mossad and you refer to even CIA and MI6, just to give two other examples, or even other secret intelligence services, you can tell that they are running their own show totally independent, very often, of what the formal power structures are doing. I don't know if you've been able to read, but there's a report going around from Russia, actually, that the recent suicide of this guy, Kellerman, from Freddie Mac, had a lot to do with the fact that Mossad had funneled out something like $50 billion to the state of Israel.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, did you read the story I had on my website about the Madoff fraud? Now,
yes, exactly. I was thinking of that.
Well, now Madoff, what we believed and what Mohammed Rafik and myself concluded was that in fact he did run a hedge fund. That in fact the people that had money with him lost money in the hedge fund, as 70% of the hedge funds have lost. So he was one of them. And the only way that he could get the money back for his investors, and they were all very powerful Zionist-connected Jews in the world, was to say, look, we committed a fraud here, and under American law, frauds are paid back through an insurance policy written up by the American government. And not only did we pay back the money with insurance, through the courts, we actually have the right to receive more money back than we actually put into the fund. And right now, the so-called victims of Madoff are actually, in the final analysis, going to receive more money out of that fund than they actually put into it. And
We had a similar case here. When I write about Madoff down here, I call him the U.S. version of Rubén Beraja. Rubén Beraja was a guy who owned, in Argentina, who owned two banks, Banco Mayo and Banco Patricios. And he was also the number one at the DAIA, and he was indicted, among other things, for having given a kickback to one of the witnesses of, I don't know if you know that there was a major explosion here in one of the Jewish
yes.
centers.
Yes.
The Avia. And they've tried to put the blame on Iran, but if anything, the only thing that makes sense is if you look at it from the, not the Iranian connection, but the Israeli connection. And the Israeli connection runs through this guy, Rubén Beraja, who was the number one at the Amia and the Daya Jewish organizations here. He owned these two banks, and he committed a massive fraud against mostly what were local Jewish investors, who anyway got their money back through the state insurance scheme. And the funny thing about Mr. Beraja, who is in jail right now, is that when Paul Volcker, was named to siphon out $1.3 billion from the Swiss banks for the so-called Holocaust victims back in the Second World War, Mr. Volcker, who today is Obama's advisor on economic recovery, Mr. Paul Volcker, and former governor of the Federal Reserve Board, he named a group of notable men to run that thing against the Swiss. And one of the so-called notable men that he chose back in 1997 was this guy, Rubén Beraja, from Argentina. So in a way, you can see that they give themselves this aura of being above all human frailty and of being very straight and forward and so forth, and yet, you know, every now and then you realize that they are practically involved in one of the worst in some of the worst fraud cases, both in America with Madoff or with this guy Rubén Beraja in Argentina.
Well, interesting also that you brought up the fact that Israeli property was bombed in order to use it for political leverage. But you know, let's take a look at the political leverage of the Ilom City connection to the Mount Moriah building bombing, where the federal building was bombed, and we know that Strassmeyer and the Southern Poverty Law Center under Morris Dees, a supposed black organization run by Jews, was involved with a clandestine formation of this whole plot, and all of the information goes right back to them, and we've completely, through the Trinidad case and others, have proven it. So essentially, they use these things. You know, you can go on to the hundreds of hate crimes or so-called hate crimes that the Jews claim happened against them. You know, somebody puts a swastika on somebody's door and they catch it on camera, and it's actually the guy that's making the claim themselves doing the paint job. These things work quite well for them until they're caught. Now, of course, you know, that bombing in Argentina made headlines around the world. Why don't you give some details about what that was, really?
Well, there were basically two major terrorist attacks against public buildings. The first one was in March 1992 against the Israeli embassy. They had completely demolished the Israeli embassy. Luckily, quote-unquote, the ambassador had popped out to have a cup of coffee. Luckily, the camera that should have filmed the car coming in with the bomb didn't work that day. But, well, something like 80 people died in central Buenos Aires. And the second major terrorist attack was a little over 2 years later, in July 1994, when the AMIA, which was the Jewish Social Association here, was bombed in a similar way. Now, the thing is that when you look at it and you say, okay, they were two terrible attacks, that they were blamed on Islamic terrorists and Jihad and Hamas and Hezbollah and so forth. But when you look at the timeline of what was happening in the state of Israel, you get a different story. Because at that time, there was a severe and enormous power struggle within Israel, which finally ended up by removing labor from power and really placing Likud and Kadima in power starting in 1996, 1997, because this power struggle in Israel, because of the fact that Yitzhak Rabin wanted to give the Palestinians the possibility, at least he was open to say, let's discuss the possibility of a Palestinian state. In a way, if you look at the timeline, especially the AMIA attack of July 1994, the whole process comes to a head when on the 4th of November of 1995, just a little over a year later, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is shot in a public street in Tel Aviv, not by a neo-Nazi, not by an Islamic fundamentalist, but by a young agent of the Shin Bet who was an ultra-right fanatic, a Zionist fanatic. And as from that moment onwards, it's goodbye labor, and the ones who are really in power, they might have some labor support, but the ones who are really in power were the extreme right. When you start looking at it, the whole thing starts to make sense, because you figure, okay, it was part of the Israeli power structure, and they shot at each other in one of the countries having the worst internal security and safety measures, which is Argentina. And when you look at the way the two buildings were attacked, which also reminds me of the federal building in Oklahoma, and you figure, well, when did this all start? The precedent, or in other words, the if you look back in history of this type of attack, you would have to go back to the Irgun Zwei Leumis, a terrorist attack against the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in 1946, which was where the British had their military government main outpost, and that was done by the Irgun Zwei Leumi, led by Menachem Begin. So if anything, the whole practice, the whole way of the system of attacking public buildings with bombs goes back to the Zionist terrorist attacks in Palestine of the late 40s.
Well, and actually, those Irgun actually learned their dastardly craft by the Jabotinsky-led criminals who were instrumental in both consolidating control in 1917, 18, 19, and 20 over the Russian people, as well as using that same tactic in the caliphate over with Ataturk at the helm. So essentially, their ruthlessness.
It's their fingerprint, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I discovered in my research was that this man that you and I probably remember from press reading, Abu Nidal, was actually an operative for the Mossad. And you know that they marched this guy out for sympathy back in the 72 Olympics over in Munich. They got him to throw the Achille Lauro hijacking. And it's funny, they could never find the guy. And every time they needed he was kind of like the Bin Laden of the day, but in fact he was working for Mossad, and so they've used this false flag terror as a means. But I think you're right; they needed to get rid of the left wing group that was starting to hold sway within the Argentine structure, and put this right-wing radical group in. And what better way to sweep the carpet clean but to get rid of them all in just a couple of quick steps?
Exactly. Now, you know, as I listen to you, and as I listen to myself, actually, and we're discussing this, I think it's fair to tell your audience that, you know, we have to stop accepting this Walt Disney version of modern politics and modern history, which, you know, you have the good guys on the one side and the bad guys on the other side, and it's all so simplistic. We have to start understanding that, in actual fact, events are much more complicated than they really look. The way history books are written and the newspapers are written, it's always with one specific agenda and goal in mind, and that we need to start thinking with our own minds and not with the minds of the New York Times or Fox News or the people who are, or Reuters, or the people who are generating all this information, because real life is really very complicated, and the rationale, the methods used, the confusion, the engineered confusion to get people totally disoriented is very powerful indeed, especially now that we have TV, internet, newspapers, a lot of radios and everything. So it is very difficult to stay, you know, always facing north, but I think that any intelligent, self-respecting person nowadays, whether it be in France, South Africa, the United States or Argentina, has to do their own thinking and has to figure out, okay, I'm not going to accept this Walt Disney wonder world of the news and history books, and I'm going to start looking at things for myself. That is why they're making an all-out effort to avoid, even to penalize, anybody who is a true independent thinker. But it's the only way out we have, because the other way is to just accept these invisible mental chains that they use to tie us and make us victims of their own perverse objectives and interests.
And you're basically correct in that most of the public has lost their capacity to discern fact from fiction, but by design. Part of it, I believe, is the mercury content of a lot of the vaccines they get as children. I think their capacity to and abilities to link concepts has been eroded. But then you've got heavy metals being sprayed in our skies. I don't know if you get that in your country, but
yes, the chemtrails.
Oh, here it's heavy, and of course it's been analyzed. It's full of aluminum and barium, and of course what we know about those two things is they have a dual effect on the body. They cause a reduction in your intellect. They also cause a reduction in your ability to fight disease. But then we have the fluoride in the water in America. So what you end up with is a rather sickly, incapacitated, and poorly informed individual that is not able to string together a good thinking. And you know, it's not until you step back from the food system that you've been thrown into and the rest of it the fog begins to clear. And if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, you know, it's probably a duck.
That's exactly it. Well, that's part of the chemical warfare we are being subject to, which goes hand in hand with the biological warfare that we're probably seeing with this swine flu thing that's so much in the news now, supposedly starting in Mexico, and that's putting everybody in panic. I think they very well know and understand that the more people panic, the more controllable they are, and the more they will be agreeable to somebody standing up one day and saying, okay, we've got so many global problems, pandemics, global terrorism, as this guy from the Financial Times said, the global financial crisis, global warming, everything is global. You know what, world? We need a global government. We need a world government. So every time they can put us on the verge of a nervous breakdown as a people throughout the world means that we are edging that much closer to a world government, because what they need is for the world government not to be imposed militarily, but to be accepted voluntarily by at least a large majority of the people.
Well, that's right. And, you know, before we went on air tonight, Adrian, I gave you my research take on very simple, very substantial things that you, your family, and those around you can do in the event of an epidemic. And epidemics do happen when they're designing these things. If they inflict them on your area population through the vaccines or what other means, people do get sick and they die. But if you are not taking those vaccines and you've got these other rational precautions already to be employed, the fear doesn't need to be there. You can go forward with strength. And that's one of the things, see, people don't like to think through the problems they've got. They would rather have someone else do the thinking for them and then have them, present a solution. And see, this is one of the things that the American government was founded against. We were told that, not only do you have freedom, but you also have responsibility. And what they're trying to do today is through this nanny state structure, is make everybody taken care of, from cradle to grave. As long as you don't put your head up above the parapet, you'll be just fine. And now, of course, that's not true. Their goal is to reduce the population, because clearly they believe there are too many of us running around. However, you can see the problem here, because when you're trying to convince the Argentines around you of these facts, you can see the glazed look. I get it in France. You get it in America. They look at you like, where are you? What are you? What? Huh? Where are you? What? What? and you just look at them and go, oh boy, there's a wall in front of me. I'm never going to break through. Now, that's not everybody, but you know what? That's the majority, sadly.
You know, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. However, I am almost incurably optimistic. I'm one of those guys who will always be half filled, never half empty.
Me too.
And I still insist, because I have faith in something which transcends the basic human physical existence on this planet.
Yep.
I truly believe that once we get that critical mass going in Argentina, in France, in South Africa, in the United States, in Britain, and you get that critical mass of people convinced and willing to do something about it, you start changing everything for everybody. And very often you think, oh, that critical mass has to be 20% of the population or 30%. It might only be 1 or 2% of the population willing to actively do something about it. Let's not forget that if you look at the history of human of mankind for the last 5,000, 6,000 years, it is the history of minorities doing things which are later understood and followed by the vast majority.
Well, that's right. And every idea starts with one and then branches out from there. And here's the thing. The American Revolution, at its one of its high points, only had a very strong adherence of 5%. You know, there were people going along with it, but they weren't. They were kind of going with the wind here. But 5% had at the core, and I mean, they took on the most powerful regime in the world of its day. Of course, the Hessians and the British, and defeated them, and then did it. And then 8-9 years later, in 1812, did it again.
And at one point, you guys were losing, and look at the way it turned out. So, you know, even when you think you're losing, you never know. At the 11th hour, things just can turn around, and you can actually win. So, actually, the inscrutable way that history moves is our true mystery. And in a way, if we open our intuition, we can start feeling that those silent waves of history ebbing and going backwards and forwards. And it's like a surfer. A surfer really does nothing. He just stands on a surfboard and knows how to ride the wave. He has no engine. He doesn't move his feet. He just knows how to keep the balance and how to ride the wave correctly. So in a way, what you do, what I do, what the people who are listening to you, I think, are trying to do is that we're trying to learn how to ride the proper wave of history. And if you listen carefully to those silent forces, in spite of the fact that they want to impose a world government and they want to impose the most perverse system, the most perverse system one can possibly imagine, the truth of the matter is that the next stage of human evolution or human or mankind's history is not theirs. It belongs to us.
I think you are 100% correct. And you know something, Adrian? I am certainly an optimist as well. I do like to point out, though, that good intentions without good works go nowhere. I mean, you know how many great ideas have died on the vine because of inaction. And one of the great challenges I've always faced is to get people to take action. And we've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world that are going to listen to this broadcast, 150 countries. And the fact is instead of just listening, what we need from them is actual action. See, this information without action is really neutered. It's moot, and it needs to have people willing to be the water bearers, the carriers of this message. And that's the kind of thing that I hope to motivate, because again, you're right. I believe ultimately this evil will fall victim to its own sickness. And you know, look, you take immoral people from around from this group and try, and you know, immoral people will act against each other in the final analysis, and I think they're probably their own worst enemy. And this is one of my great hopes. The other thing I've always hoped, and maybe you'll agree with this, is we're getting close to the end here. I've always hoped that I could recruit as many Jews as I could, because bringing the Jews into this from outside, they can go into their own community and undermine these criminals' control from inside, something I can't do.
Daryl, that's exactly one of the things that we do down here. What we tell them is we're doing it for your own good, because you're being coaxed by a leadership that is really going to get you into a lot of trouble. And a lot of ignorant people, when they finally react, they might think it's the fault of all Jews, and it's not the fault of all Jews. It's the fault of their Zionist leadership.
That's right.
Down here, we're promoting what we call the Argentine Second Republic movement, because we feel that we have to found the Republic anew. Just as France did, going from the Fourth to the Fifth Republic, we have to go from our present colonially structured Republic into a true Second Republic that will be sovereign. Now, the way we're doing is we're trying to convince everybody that everybody has to pitch in, and that certainly includes the Jewish community, which, as I said at the beginning of the program, is very peaceful. They just go around minding their own business. They're hardworking, but their own leadership within the community, the Amia and the Daya and these organizations, really coax them and use them against their own best interests, because they use them for the interests of the State of Israel instead of using them to favor the interests of Argentina, which is where their future is going to be. That's why they live here. Otherwise, they would have gone to Israel.
You're exactly right, Adrian. We're at the end of the show, Adrian. I want to give you an opportunity here maybe to address, this is a Pan-African, European, and North American audience primarily, and I want to give you an opportunity to address them with any parting statement you'd like to make.
very, very briefly, I think that this, for the first time in mankind's history, it's not a question of national liberation as we heard throughout the 20th century. This is something where every country has a common enemy because it is not a specific country. It is a specific power group, and that power group is really putting its foot on top of South Africa, on top of France, on top of Argentina, Brazil, the United States, Britain, India, Japan. Every country is feeling the tremendous weight of that boot. Like George Orwell said, I can imagine the future as a boot stomping on a face time and again, time and again. He said that in his novel 1984. So in a way, let's take advantage of all the electronics we have nowadays, the internet, radio programs, TV programs and everything, to bring everything together, to start working towards a common goal and a common action, which is not just for one specific country, but it's for all countries at the same time. And I think guys like you, like me, that can communicate to other countries and to other people, we really bear upon our shoulders the responsibility of getting the word across. And I would only repeat what you said a few minutes ago. Don't just sit in your living room and watch TV and zap through all the, do zapping through all the channels. Start doing something about it in your local community, because just the way as this new world order is crushing us from the top downwards, the reaction is going to come from downwards upwards. And it's downwards means in every home, in every block, in every community.
Thank you, Adrian. You know, Adrian, I hope you'll accept an invitation to come back in a future date here on the CII, on Channel Islam International, with me on French Connection broadcast. Because next time we do something, what I'll do is we'll start doing some more specific research on some of this. Because what I did tonight with you was did an overall picture of this conspiracy by jumping from one part of it to the next. Next time I'd like to maybe start dissecting some of the more salient issues that we can expose and do it through some of your great research, and I hope you'll come back.
Whenever you say, I'm here to help, and it's been a real pleasure, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity to address your audience.
Thanks, Adrian. I'm very grateful to have you on, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, Adrian Salvucci from Argentina, a real gentleman and a real world patriot, and somebody who should be venerated for his efforts, because he has done all in his power to make the truth part of his life. You know, ladies and gentlemen, we are working here against the clock, and one of the things that I want everybody to understand out there in this listening audience, I don't do this for fame or fortune. I do it because I've seen the evil that is in the breast of these human beings. I dare say they're not even human in my view, because human beings don't act the way these criminals do. They're criminals for sure. They need to be stopped, and I need your help to do it. So until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, this is Darrell Bradford Smith telling all of you, please, take care of your families. Be rational. Do the right thing by yourself morally and spiritually and educationally and in your health. And until the next time, be well.